Welcome to Holden Village. Today in the Creekside Room, Diane Shelton will be discussing moving beyond the fear of inclusion through communication. So, let's listen in on Diane.
I felt like, oh, this is going to be a safe environment. That was my primary goal for myself at that point, was to be safe. Well, we got there. And the first thing I noticed is that I was the only single parent family in camp. And this was specifically family camp. It was the week from hell. I was an invisible person. My children were invisible children. It went beyond being invisible to being actively excluded. During every morning, we had a Bible study time, and the message I got very clearly, even though it might not have been spoken, was, please don't join our group. The men didn't know how to relate to me, and the women were openly hostile. An example of that was, well, there were several examples. I'll give you a couple. The women were going to go on a day outing, and they were going to go look at some of the bed and breakfasts around the area. Everyone was informed but me. That was kind of at the end. But some things that happened before that were things like just maintenance things. I would come into the dining room with my children, and in one circumstance, we were having pancakes. Now, those of you with young children know that pancakes are not just throw them in front of them and say, eat. There's butter, there's syrup, there's cutting, there's, oh, you need to get this, you know, cut this one differently, you know, all those instructions. So finally, I had their pancakes ready, sat down to eat, and the waitress whisked my plate away and said, breakfast is over. And I hadn't been late, by the way. It just took a while. Plus the fact that no one who saw me struggling through the line with a 3- and a 5-year-old offered to help. Now, you think I'm exaggerating. Not in the least. Another situation was that, for instance, my son wanted to go out on the lake. My daughter wanted to stay on the shore. When there's one parent and two children, what do you do? I asked one of the summer staff, could you please take my son out in a boat? No. Well, by the end of the week, I was even more devastated than I had been when I arrived. I couldn't believe what had happened. I tried talking to the pastor, and he said something about, well, you know, we don't usually have single parents come. In fact, you know, I think you might be one of the first. And I'm thinking, this is incredible to me because it's a huge area. I mean, a huge geographical area that this camp drew from. Other single parents probably had the sense to think ahead that, you know, this might not be the place to go. Well, it just so happened that one of the administrators from Washington, who was from the ELCA, happened to be visiting when I was there. So I asked for a meeting with him and with the director of the camp to tell them about my experience, never being one to hold back its worth. And I described my ordeal as I was feeling that it was at that time and got very little response. Kind of insinuating that it was my problem. Oh, you know, you've just been going through this rough time. It's really your problem. Well, that made me even a little bit more angry. And so I went back to my congregation where I was on the Church and Society Board, and I said, you know what, I don't want to send, and we sent, our church is a large congregation in Mankato, Minnesota, we sent a considerable amount to support this camp on a regular basis, and it came out of our committee. And I said, you know, I don't want to send these people any money. And these are the reasons. And I talked to my pastor about it. And again, it was kind of like, well, this is your problem. But we did write a letter. My point to the story is, we all experience exclusion at different times in our life. What do we do with that, and how do we prevent it, and why does it happen? Why are we afraid of what I've come to in this scenario is that the response that I got from this group of people said far more about them than about me. They were afraid of me. They were afraid of a single woman in their midst. They were afraid of the fact that I was divorced. You know, what does that mean in the Lutheran Church to be divorced? Do you know that if you want to become a pastor, which I've looked at different times in my life, you have a lot of explaining to do if you're divorced. You just don't get the same sort of, well, come on in, we'd like to have you in our community. We could go around the room and name lots of different ways that the Lutheran Church is exclusionary. How many of you were at Mike's session this morning on Mark? You were there. Were you there? You were there, weren't you? Mm-hmm. You were there, the early one?
Mm-hmm.
He talked about what I think is at the base of exclusion. That is, now the interesting thing about fear is that we don't all have the same fears, do we? So, if I were to come to your church or meet you with two children as a single parent, you're thinking to yourself, but we all have different fears. Someone says, well, I feel really comfortable working with this population. But someone else over here may not. Now, this is the cognitive piece, and now I'm going to talk about, first of all, I'm going to name you. I'm going to name you all teachers. Because in reality, you are all teachers. Does anybody disagree with that? You teach by modeling, by what we say, by what we know, for sure what we do. There are always children and other adults watching us to learn how we handle different situations, so we're all teachers. We'll just start with that premise. The next piece that I'd like to talk about is, what is the cognitive process that sort of gets us into an exclusionary mode? An exclusionary mode to the point where we will actively fight to keep a group of people out of our church or out of our midst, or inactively do the same thing by just shutting down and not doing anything. It's okay with it. How many of you studied Piaget in school? You all know the name, at least. He was a Swiss psychologist, and he came up with sort of a model like Freud did, only his model had to do with how we learn things cognitively. And some of the words that he used were schemata, assimilation, accommodation, equilibrium, and disequilibrium. And we're going to talk about those words a little bit because I think that they're at the basis of our fear. It's kind of, how did we get here? And how can we actively change and help other people change that base fear? And those of you with young children are in a great position to actively do this. Okay, first of all, what all of us in this room actively seek every single minute of every single day is equilibrium. We want to have just the right amount of food, right? We want just that right amount of sleep, that right amount of time to ourselves, we actively will work against discomfort. Okay, so we are seeking equilibrium. Now, how does that make? Where's your equilibrium there? These don't work. They're getting dry. People in the therapy mode sometimes use the word homeostasis. We're always working toward equilibrium. Our children are working toward equilibrium when they need something and they let us know they need it. I mean, what they want. Yeah.
Can I raise a point about? I think even if you didn't do it on purpose, you misspelled that word on purpose. Yes. Yes, but.
I'm not even seeing it.
EQIL.
EQUIL. But I don't think you ought to change it.
Equal.
Yes, I don't think you ought to change it.
I'm thinking equal.
Yeah, it's a very good.
Okay.
I like it like that. Put it in quotes or something. Yeah. Uh-huh. I like it like that.
Isn't that interesting? And I didn't even see it when I looked at it. Of course, I'm a terrible speller, so that just explains it all to me. Spelling.
I needed it right for my.
Okay, that's good. No, I love that because that is very, very true.
Try to avoid discomfort.
And I also know equilibrium is a part of that.
Oh.
And I never thought of it like
that. That's very good.
It's probably working.
Yeah. Yes, I mean. Let's see, what is that called? So we're all trying to do this. We're trying to reach that. And those of us in churches are trying to reach some equilibrium, right? Now let's say, what is your fear? And that's one of the major things that we need to do is identify what is my fear. Oftentimes we can say, that's not my fear, that's not my fear, that's not my fear. But what is your fear? Is your fear that the Lutheran Church would ordain a gay or lesbian pastor? Is that your fear? Is your worst fear that there will be so many people from another culture in your church that they will take over? Is your fear that you will have people with multiple handicapping conditions, including people with mental illness at your church? Now, I think if we look at back to cognition, all of those are reasonable fears. Our behavior, because of our fears, is what becomes the unreasonable part, just like children. We're no different, we're just taller. And our fears become very covert and hidden, like a camp. We don't want you here. They were pretty blunt, but they didn't verbalize that, for heaven's sakes. How does that happen? Well, it starts out with something called schemata. And schemata you can think about as little index cards. Is it all coming back to you now? Little index cards of what we learn through life. What are our experiences? And everyone in this room has very different experiences. Start over here with experiences. That's why I
created that. Since I haven't studied Piaget, does that mean that you're going to say that this is a learned behavior? That the need for equilibrium is a learned behavior rather than a genetically
It's a drive. It's both. Piaget would say that it's both. We are within us. We are always striving to learn. We don't need outside influences to help us learn to learn. We, from the time we come out of the womb, want to learn. That's why we touch, taste, smell, experience the world, and it never quits. It's always there. But the nature-nurture part comes in. Who were you born, what's your family look like? Okay. learn a tremendous amount in relation to the family that we happen to be born into. And not only specific things, but inferred things. And we all know that, right? We all know what the attitudes were in our family. Okay, so we're little, our parents, we go with our parents down to a drugstore, we watch their attitudes in terms of how they address someone who's a clerk, someone who's at a different socioeconomic level than they might be. Always watching, remember I said your teachers, you're part of that schematic that they're learning. Okay, how then, you know, for instance, when they start out that first year, their schematic is mostly taken in by motor interaction with the environment. The table, the floor. And the world becomes labeled for them in a concrete kind of way. As time and as the schematic is there, they begin to assimilate and accommodate new info. Now this, if you can hang in there with me just a minute, I think this helps understand a lot of how we get here. And if also, what I'd like you to also think about is, if you're in a congregation, if you're in your family, whatever situation, if you keep this kind of in mind, then you can influence how this equilibrium and loss of fear can actually take place. Assimilation means that we're taking in more information about something we already have a name for or know something about. Now, let's say that in your family, well, not uncommon, that your father grew up in the South and is very biased against people of color, African Americans. Okay. As we grow up, the schemata or the main message doesn't change from our father. We just keep getting more information. So, if this is a balloon about prejudice, the prejudice that we're experiencing in our household, it just keeps getting bigger and bigger and bigger with more information. Now, the accommodation part is if all of a sudden you have a new experience or something happens to you or you hear something that doesn't fit into this. And that's why I heard a woman say today, well, we work with the Hispanic population or whatever it was, and you know, my experiences are really good, and she said one-on-one. That's right. Or someone else said, we got involved with the people from Vietnam, families coming to our church. That's where accommodation starts taking place. Where we are now getting new information. Now, I've grown up my whole life hearing about the prejudice against African American people. And all of a sudden, I go to college and my roommate is black. Does that fit into what I'm learning now about her? And this is my first real life experience with an African American person. And it doesn't fit anymore into what I know. So, what happens? Am I in a state of equilibrium at this point? No. Now I'm in a state of disequilibrium. And that is when we learn. So, what I would challenge people to do in your families, in your churches, in your schools, is to set up instances of disequilibrium. When I went to camp, I put that whole camp in a state of disequilibrium. They didn't know what to do with me. Now, unfortunately, I was not in a place to address this.
My daughter's looking through the window.
I wasn't in a place to actually do some teaching and learning. Excuse me one minute.
What she needs.
Oh, come in, sit down. What's this? Come on in. Okay, so what I've done, simply by being in their midst, unbeknownst to me, without naming a thing, I've thrown the place into a state of deceit. Now, what I wasn't able to do is go back and say, tell me about your schemata, your background with people who are divorced. What experiences did you have? How had you assimilated what that meant? Now, I could guess, but that wouldn't get us very far. The idea would be to say, tell me about your experiences. Same kind of things happen when, for instance, in our church, a man comes who's obviously mentally ill. And what I see is everybody's running as quickly as possible to the other side of the church, as far away as possible. Because what do we have? What have we assimilated? And then the challenge becomes, again, setting up a disequilibrium. Now, I'd like to open this up and talk a little bit about your own experiences, and maybe we can use the same kind of ideas to talk them through. And what I like to always think about is the assimilation part, the accommodation part, and then the plan for action. One of the things, too, back here in the schemata, as you're interacting with children or people you live with, is to check out, you know, what are they learning? If we don't actively check that out, we make a lot of assumptions about where people are. And that's what I think people, children and people in groups, really act on their fear rather than life and information. And tell me about any, yeah.
Well, I was just curious, in your experience with this camp situation, you were the one that was, sort of being boycotted.
Yes,
then.
Yes.
And that person to go back to people that are boycotting them, it doesn't seem like it can work that way. It seems like it has to work the other way, where you see someone isolated, you go to them and make yourself uncomfortable, essentially. If someone in that group had come to you, then perhaps there was room for teaching and being loved.
Right.
But how could it work the other way?
And I'm thinking in terms of a parent to a child who's watching it, or a church member who's seeing a dynamic starting to happen. One of the things I think with the fear piece is that, you know how we band together in groups? We do that because we're so afraid of the disequilibrium. So if we're at the top of the pyramid, like Mike talked about today, I am not. Why on earth would I do anything to create a sense of disequilibrium for myself? I'm not going to. I'm at the top. I'm comfortable.
It seems to me, what you're saying is that there is no desire on what you're saying, the Lutheran Christian, to be a Christian. Because to do what you suggesting we need to do is to act in the love of Christ. And of course, that is what's bothering me about the Lutheran Church, because we have lost, I think, in large measure, the desire to really be little Christ.
Mm-hmm. Well, and when I think you look at it this way, again, I ask the question, why would you desire to be in a state of disequilibrium? We are going, what I'm saying is, it's no mystery to me why congregations, families, institutions fight like crazy to maintain the status quo. Because remember, our organism, our body, who we are, what we're about, is always fighting for equilibrium. We don't want to be uncomfortable. We don't want to be. So we can take this way out in terms of the United States. I don't want to know the underbelly. I don't want to have to put myself on the line. So that's why I made the statement this morning about the connection between theory, and I think this is what you're saying too, and practice. Theory is equilibrium. I can sit in this room and hear your theory. And I'm still okay. I can do this assimilating and accommodating in my head and come away saying, well, yeah, you know, I think that I could really allow this group of people in. But then, when it comes down to, like we talked about last week, for instance, a church who opens their doors to gays and lesbians and marries them and all sorts of things like that. Well, what about if they're my child Sunday school teacher? That's the practice piece. And that throws me into disequilibrium. I would like to please avoid that. Yeah.
I keep looking for one word up there, which is what seems to me to be a goal, and that is acceptance. I mean, that's also what we are basically looking for in this whole challenge. And,
but how can I accept if I'm fearful? And how can I accept if my fear is based on a history of erroneous information or experiences that have been negative? I agree with you. We all want acceptance. Bottom line, rejection is horrendous. You know, I mean, rejection is one of the most horrendous states of disequilibrium. We don't belong. So it's a tough. So, yeah.
But that's where the educational process comes in. As you would indicate, the reflection and the accommodation. I kind of thought when you were drawing the circle for assimilation, that perhaps instead of getting bigger, that you indicated acquiring knowledge. And as you acquire knowledge, I would have thought the circle would have been reversed and perhaps gotten smaller.
Not if the information is still along, going into a certain schemata that already exists.
Well, I can see both sides of that.
Then it just keeps growing.
Yeah, because you have a lot of those balloons about all different topics.
Right, exactly.
In your brain, and that one particular one.
Yeah, just gets filled and filled and filled. Just like if you have a loving mother who accepts you and brings you in and nurtures you and cares for you and loves you, that balloon also of assimilation gets bigger and bigger and bigger. But then, let's say you get married and you have a mother-in-law that doesn't look like that at all. Oh, here is a mother, but I have to, it doesn't fit into my old schemata. I can't fit this mother law into my schemata of what a mother is. So So now I have to change that based on my new experience and new information. And if then that information doesn't fit here, then I need to create a meta, right? Or change the old one. And that's where we as educators come in, as teachers. How do we give information that changes old schematic? This is the piece I think we miss massively. We jump way over to equilibrium. We want to be, we want, you know, someone in the church says, I'd like to include this population more actively in our church. And then you get this resistance. Oh, no, 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 no. Because what we've forgotten is that every single member is coming in with their own schematic, their own history of experience and interaction, and that's what they're going to be responding to. And often, it's fear. I don't have a schematic for this, and the one I do makes me afraid of what could happen.
What if, just to take the other side of things, what if there had been some learning, some practical hands-on bad experiences that a certain type of person or a certain race or a certain way of being, or and it wasn't just built on false assumptions, it was based on their own life. They'd been raped by somebody, or they had, you know, something had told them this wasn't a good thing in their life or for their children or for their spouse. That's not a balloon that's filled with hot air.
These are not hot air. I want to be real clear about that. This is not hot air. This is your reality. And that's what we have to respect about the fear piece too. That's your reality. Yes, if you were raped by someone, that is your schematic. And how you were responded to. I mean, absolutely.
Sometimes you can dismiss people that are sounding fearful as being, oh, you just want to keep everything the same and equal all the time. Well, perhaps.
Exactly.
They have some valid reasons.
Exactly.
Not wanting change.
Exactly. Exactly, exactly, exactly. And that's why I'm saying, don't just discount what's happening here. Address it, name it, discuss it, put it on the table. Have forums and situations where not only can we hear what was your experience, tell us about your experience in a non-threatening kind of way, where we're just sharing those experiences. There aren't going to be any decisions made here. We're just going to share some of these experiences. Then the other, because then we hear, again, tell me about, or even using like, what if this happened? Then you can hear people's fears and concerns and all that kind of thing, right? The next piece then is, once we get that information, how do we set up situations to change the schematic? And people do that one-on-one, by interactions, by stories, by concrete information, by dinners and informal kinds of interactions, so that it's non-threatening and non-fearful, and slowly people will accommodate.
Very slowly.
Very slowly.
Something that I kind of noticed in racism and discomfort around handicapped people is that the individual dynamic with, like you had earlier said, one-on-one, somebody talked about having they had a very good relationship one-on-one with Hispanics. The individual dynamic is considerably different than the group dynamic. The group dynamic is quite often not a democratic 51% rules. There can be a little bit of poison, and it affects everything.
Oh, you bet. This is a simple kind of thing, but this is huge. This is deep and huge, and people will fight to their death for the schematic that they know. Don't make me, they'll kill themselves. People will kill themselves before they will move toward a different state of accommodation or a new schematic.
theory practice thing works well in one-on-one.
In a group, yes.
But in a group, it just falls apart.
You're being observed too by others and judged by others.
And you get another disequilibrium.
Right.
You know, yes, you might have the majority of a group may decide that a certain situation, which would be a change, is acceptable to them. But when there's a little bit of resistance, then that sets up a different equilibrium. Now you have to confront the people who aren't that willing to accommodate. And rather than do that, your old schemata or your old everything you've learned is still there. And it's still, you know, people will fall back on
that. You stand up to make a point and someone takes your seat.
Yeah. Well, and that's why, you know, when you talk about the Lutheran Church and kind of where are we, what are we about, I think our leaders have to be, you know, it would be ideal if the leaders could do some of this work for us. Some of it's not necessarily just a debatable kind of thing either. It's, this is the information, this is what we're going to try and do. I'm going to intentionally throw you into a state of disequilibrium. I am for states of disequilibrium, because that's when we're stretched and we learn. I think this forest fire is a good example of that. How many of us have been thrown into a state of disequilibrium because of the forest fire? Anybody have an experience there yet?
Well, we didn't get a chance to hike to Holden Lake like we wanted to, and we had encouraged a couple from church to come, saying it's such a beautiful place, you know, and all the mountains were gorgeous. Well, you know, we didn't get a chance to really see them. Furthermore, they had left early because Kello has a little breathing problem, and this woman got to him. And
so your whole schemata about Holden Village has changed based on your experience with the forest fire. Was that ever there before?
Some of it's changed, you know, a lot.
Right, right. But in terms of just the forest fire piece, have you ever been here when there were forest fires like this before?
No, I've only been once before, and it was absolutely beautiful then.
I think the safety that people feel here.
It's disequilibrium.
Well, the fear of death, ultimately. I just think, you know, life is fragile in the midst of this huge fire. My husband's out fighting this fire, too. And,
oh, is he?
Yeah, and just thinking that, you know, 15 people were killed in a forest fire in Idaho a couple months ago. And just, life is very fragile. I'm very just equalized. You know,
right.
Very fearful.
And the thing about what's happening, and I don't know if you can talk about this at this point, but you're probably developing new, you're accommodating and developing new schemata based on this experience. Is that a fair thing to say?
I would say giving up control, perhaps, too, and just saying, what can I do? You know, I can
plan for action.
Pray about it, plan for action, you know, try to keep a routine and keep, you know, Claire, you know, 4-year-old, okay.
Mm-hmm.
Reassure that otherwise, yeah.
No.
I guess that would be accommodating.
That's accommodating.
Learning.
You bet. And the other thing about states like this is that kind of hindsight idea that after we've been through it, then we can say, then the next time, hopefully there's not a next time, but the next time, now we have a new schematic that we can assimilate more information into. For instance, I took the train to Holden for the first time 4 years ago. I had no schematic for that. I went, we made it, we got here. This time, I knew a lot more about that I could put into action, which reduced the disequilibrium so that I could extend that experience.
Well, I think one of the things that can set some people show to me that they're different, that they learn faster, they're more liberal, or something, is maybe one of your, I'm sure everyone has a schemata somewhere in their brain that says, how firm are my other schemata? How easily can I accommodate anything, whatever it is?
And do you know what? Piaget says that the way we do that, each of us does that differently. And we do it the same way our whole life. So, you're right. If you accommodate and assimilate in a certain way, and it starts in your youth, it continues. That's not going to change it. That's why sometimes you see people that this process is long and hard and tough.
Depends how they did on Myers-Briggs. Well, or that's an indicator.
That could be. That could be. Yeah. It also could be just the schematic for learning. How did you learn to learn? Did I learn to learn? Was it an easy kind of thing for me? Did I get energy from that? Or was it hard? Was it painful? Was I accepted for how I learned? You know, all those kinds of things.
As children grow, they finally stop saying, "But you said."
Yeah.
Well, yes, I did, but things are different now. You know, how quickly do they accommodate to that change?
And if, you know, this is just fascinating. If you can take this home, put it in, and then the next time you have a church meeting or a family meeting and you present something new and you present something that's challenging, different, whatever, watch people. Listen to them. And listen to, what do they know? How are they taking the information in? And sometimes you can actually see people do that. You can see them think and take it in. What do they do with that information? Do they go around and cause all sorts of problems? Do they whisper? Do they say, "Wow, I think that's really crazy. I don't want to do that." Or, "You know, that's a really good idea. I hadn't thought of that before." And anytime you hear, "I hadn't thought about that before in that way," that person is accommodating. They're taking in new information. And as they're doing that, they're trying to reach some equilibrium. Those of you with young children get to see this in action every single minute of every single day. Adults, you have to listen a little more. My major point here is that if we truly want to get to inclusion in our congregations, in our homes, in any new environment, we can't skip the steps. We can't skip where the people in the room have come from. Especially when you start hearing resistance, exclusion, there's a fear connection, and automatically think, this person's in a state of disequilibrium. Not this jerk. I have to deal with this jerk now. Doesn't understand this idea. Stupid. You know, all those thoughts we have. You can choose to do that, or you can think, look at the disequilibrium here. I wonder what the past schematic is. I wonder what this person's experiences and learning and knowledge have been. Maybe I can find out by a one-on-one discussion. Maybe I can find out by a conversation in a group. I noticed you were really upset when they talked about putting in some handicap accessibility. And they're going to say, "Well, yeah, money. I mean, look at one person and the money." Well, tell me about the people you've known with handicapping conditions. Okay? Get to some of that. And then bring in new information. Now, this is a reality, too, and we all know it, right? There's got to be some window of motivation. There has to be some desire to add new schematic. Now, Piaget would say we all have that all the time. But I think by the time we're adults, sometimes that shuts us down pretty tough in some areas. So you can only do what you can do. But you can be a model. And you can put some of it into practice by how you address the fear and go back to the beginning. Because until we address the fear, we are not going to make any inroads. Yes?
I think there's also an element of risk that is involved in changing this schematic. For example, in our church, we changed some of the worship service to include different hymns and use a different hymnal. Mm-hmm. And there were actually individuals who dropped out of the church. Mm-hmm. They were not going to change. They just felt that they were not comfortable with anything new.
They were fearful.
A couple
nights ago, I sat in
the vestry, and someone in back of me said they had been here some days now and had yet to sing a Lutheran hymn. That's another exhibit of this schematic.
You bet.
And maybe that's what they were looking for, but on the other hand, it certainly hadn't bothered me. I think that you come to learn something new, or to see what the trend is, or to broaden your horizon as such. And a lot of people do not feel comfortable with this. And I think this turmoil is going on in many churches today in terms of the whole gay lesbian movement, terms of the acceptance of people of other races and so forth. And you mentioned divorce and all these kinds of things. I have to tell you that some 4 years ago, we moved to Reno, Nevada. I'd been from the East Coast, from the Washington, D.C. area, and I lived in Minnesota before that, and in Richmond, Virginia. The church that we selected to join is a very open, liberal church. I didn't know that the man who was singing in the choir next to me was gay. A lot of the people, as you might expect in a Reno congregation, were on the second time around in their marriages, fully accepted, never questioned. Raised. Everybody pitches in and does the job. An amazing amalgamation, the kind of thing that people in some Minnesota towns that I know about and have lived in and have been a part of the churches would find even very difficult back in the 60s when there was a debate going on in Minneapolis as to whether or not stores should be open on Sunday, and whether gasoline stations should be open on Sunday, and the church jumps in with both feet, making an issue over this, which they promptly lost. I used to take my Sunday school class bowling after Sunday school on Sunday morning after church.
And so you were changing their
command. I got calls from parents about this.
Jimmy, why don't you just tell them a little experience about the woman in front of us when you said you were from Reno?
Here at Holden?
Yes.
Well, she asked me when I saw something that indicated she was from Minneapolis, and I was just looking back for it. But I noticed that she was from Minneapolis. She was wearing some light blue clothing, which identified this, and, or at least said Twin Cities. And I said, would those Twin Cities be Minneapolis and St. Paul? Yes. Well, I used to live there. Where do you live now? In Reno.
Reno.
Sin City.
Yeah. Hey.
Schematic.
I don't remember who did it. I mean, I don't remember who even said it, but while I've been here,
I heard somebody say that they, and you guys may even recognize who, if somebody in the staff maybe said that they had moved. They were a pastor, I think, and they had moved from Reno to Las Vegas. Does that ring a bell? I just heard that a few days ago. And I really feel like, I thought, gee, that's strange. And then I'm going to ask yeah, so even, you know, no matter how liberal you think you are, you see these twinges, and then you kind of put them aside and go, why am I thinking that that should be strange?
Right, and I guess...
Why those two cities? I don't want to live in either one.
Right, but I think it raises a good point, and that is the thing that I hopefully that this has kind of spurred in people, is to think about what are our schematics. Another word might be, what are our biases? You know, what schemata have we assimilated a lot of bias into? And then how do we actively, after naming that, try and create a new perspective?
We educate everybody that comes to visit us.
And that's what you need, that's
and
great.
We take them to the university, we show them the beautiful residential areas, and we point out the quality of life we have there, and cultural things that are available, and the casinos are just a small part of it.
But you understand that through our information, that's all we've got. And until I come to visit you, it's not going to change.
Of course, the fact that there's a lot of casinos around Minnesota now, you know,
yes.
Minnesota,
yeah.
they don't can't crow much about it anymore, can they?
No, they sure can't.
And that's why a lot of times people continue with the old schemata until they meet somebody individually that can help them.
Well, and then they'll learn, too, that's some people's recreation. Oh, you can spend $40 a day to go skiing. Maybe they put $40 aside to just go and have fun with that, you know. As long as it's not abused, that, and you can abuse anything, you can abuse eating, you know. But if you can't afford to do the gambling, then you don't, we say gaming now.
But as we grew up, we were pumped full of the evils of gambling.
Well, and what those places look like. To me, all I think of, desert and casinos. Period. That's my schematic for what you're talking about. Not wonderful, warm people like you. I think, well, all those people out there, all they're doing is, you know.
No, Reno's beautiful, too.
Oh,
what's up with that?
Most wonderful climate and most beautiful geography around it. It's a little valley. And, I mean, it's a little town and a little valley.
And so by talking to you, I am sitting here adjusting, accommodating my image of Reno. And that's what happens in our, it's simple, but it's huge. It's how I'm not afraid of that place anymore, how I'm not afraid of who you are because you might be different than me. But when we skip this piece and go right to, okay, this is our policy, folks, it's all gonna come out.
And the challenge then with children, for me, is Claire wants to play with Barbie dolls. Stand Barbie dolls. I don't like what they stand for. I've read all the articles, but she loves them, you know. And so, how do I, as a parent, accept her and give her information and not shun, you know, some outlet?
The first thing that comes to mind is you play Barbie dolls with her, and you introduce non-stereotypical ideas.
You live with war toys.
You do the same thing. You engage with.
And also, what I've been real clear with her is what I feel about them and why. She knows exactly why I don't like them.
You know, it's really interesting. This is kind of an aside, but they've done some research with how children play with Barbies and baby dolls. And actually, Barbie comes out ahead of the baby doll because she can go off to work and drive a car and do all sorts of things, and baby dolls just stay baby dolls. And so the role that the child maintains, yeah, while playing with the baby doll is a mother.
Baby dolls are great. Yeah.
Yeah.
The dimensions are
great. So it's back to that same kind of thing. What you're afraid of something. I mean, based on your schematic that I'm hearing, you're afraid that she's going to grow up kind of with a stereotypical idea of what
image of her. What she truly is going to be, probably.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So what you want to do is help her develop different schematics.
Name it.
Always name it. And naming is so important. Naming our fears, naming our action, naming what you see, naming differences. Naming differences is okay. That's one of the things we've come out of a period where we're trying to all be the same. We're not the same. We're different. And that's okay.
It is accepting that. That's a hard thing to do and that we need to all work on.
And that's where we need more information and new experiences. That's how we change our perceptions. It's not just by having... How many people do you know, just by sitting down, if you had an opposite opinion than I do, for instance, about whatever, house husbandry, and we could sit down and talk for 2 hours, how many times after a discussion do we go away actually changing our opinion?
Not very often.
No.
Our own position.
And that's what Piaget says we do too. Piaget says that we develop our cognitive skills by arguing with each other, because what we're basically doing is taking our point of view and having to come up with lots of evidence and information. I mean, it stretches us cognitively, right? But it doesn't help accommodate necessarily new information. We can talk until we're blue in the face.
Yeah. But when discussing that with someone else who's very well-versed about the other side of the coin, if you are open to, not to change, but to listen, then you may discover that you don't have the evidence to back up your point of view that they seem to.
Right.
And they'll bring in other things that do fit in your schematic, little things.
Mm-hmm.
And the preponderance of those then gets you to change your mind.
Right, and I'm not saying it can never happen. Sure. I think lots of times I'll sit down to listen to someone. If I'm not fearful, a lot of times, if I'm fearful, I'm going to resist and shut down and prove my point oftentimes. But if we introduce new information in different ways, then hopefully that can happen. And that's a real challenge, because what it does is it helps us, we need to become educators, active educators. And that takes away some of our anger at being the one who's excluded too. It makes that shift. So I'm not having to just defend my schemata that already exists. I'm having to think about how can I give you new information or help teach you that I'm not the stereotype that was initially there. Okay. We're at the end of our session. 5 minutes ago. Go ahead.
Well, I have a very similar comment this afternoon to what I had this morning. To me, I never had time to study theology or other than the love of Christ. I didn't even know that I had a schemata until after I was retired, which was almost 15 years ago, more than that. I think I got through life being fairly well-rounded. I have certain fixed beliefs as to what life should be, but I think that I change as I acquire more information. And I think that under the plan for action that you are presenting or will present or in this schemata business, I think we've got to remember not to leave out or to include the love of Christ, because I believe that that's why I was able to get through life without a schemata and without any specific or great knowledge of theology, such as the theologians have, and such. In sociology, the theories of schemata and all of this business that sociologists or whatever the study of this area is that you folks have. And if we make either theology.